on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, sharing the hour today with 89-year-old Jonas Hofer of Fresno, California. Originally from South Dakota, he spent most of his life in Dinuba, southeast of Fresno, on the edge of Tulare County. We've already heard about his recovery from a catastrophic car accident at the age of 15, how he went on to be a track and field star for the Emperors of Dinuba High. By the way, I looked up that information on Dutch Warmerdam, and the pole vault record he set in 1942 was indeed 15 feet, 7 3/4 inches. So just in case you're wondering about Mr. Hofer's memory, looks like it's pretty spot on. When we left off, Jonas had met all the military recruiters at Reedley College. He had already spent some time in the cockpit, and he wanted to be a Navy pilot. So what did you do about it?
I joined the Navy right there, but I came home and I fooled my mother because she did not want me to fly. So the Navy had two programs, a C5, which was a cadet program, and a C12 was an officer's training program. So I asked the Navy lieutenant that was back the next day after we had signed up, after I'm in the service, can I sign over to any place I want to? Oh, yeah. He says, you're in now, and that you can. So I changed to the V5. And when I came home, I told my mother, I said, here's a V12 program. They will give us 3 years of college, and then you'll be an officer in that there. And I can just see the clicking in her head going, 1, 2, 3 years, the war will be over. If he goes 3 years, what they didn't tell us was we were going to get 3 years of college in 2 years. And it would be away in Idaho. So she signed for me because I was only 17. She had a sign. So she signed for me, and then the next day I switched over to the, I went to Idaho. That was 42. And then in 43, they took me in the Navy to Idaho and that. And I was about 2 weeks in the flight program when I played baseball on Sunday and broke my knee. So I washed out of the group and that. And they always said, well, in 3 months' time, you can get back in. But in 3 months' time, I was in the South Pacific aboard this cruiser and that. But because my knee was in a cast there, I couldn't march, so I played with the band. I played trumpet. So I played with the band and that. And they found out that I played trumpet. They sent me to San Diego to bugle school, and I was an instructor in bugle school. And 3 months later, I was on the Houston. I asked for seniority. For a musician, just to play bugle calls is kind of old. So I wanted to get out of there after 3 months. And I did.
2 months later, aboard the Houston, the second Houston, and there's a story there, and we'll get to that. And I know I keep backtracking on you, but I'm interested in one aspect of your story because I think a lot of people today have no idea what it was like. You mentioned that you had a lot of Japanese friends. You mentioned you had worked for Japanese-American farmers. So in the spring of 1942, when Executive Order 9066 happened and they're ordered to go to these internment camps, how did that play out in Dinuba, and how did that impact your world and your understanding?
Well, all my friends went to Arizona and were in the camps there, and that, and I thought that was pretty bad because they were just as loyal as I was to the United States and that. But the United States didn't consider that and sent them all there. And a few of them came back very angry. But otherwise, my friends and that, none of them did. They just figured, well, it had to be done and that. And they went away for 3 years. And after the war, they came back and went back to school and college and that. And we remained friends. And I never had it really where I was angry at every Japanese in that. I was at the head, Tojo and some of them that got them into the war. But otherwise, I always figured, well, they're like I'm doing. They're doing their duty to their country in that. And so I didn't feel bad that their hearts were all bad at us. Now, on the first Houston, I've gotten together with a bunch of them at reunions. And so I know what their stories is. They had a bad time. All of them from the first Houston went into Thailand, the prisoner of war camp. And my good friend Charlie Ross, was in there a year and a half, and then they took him out, and he was on the Burma Road working with wheelbarrows. Wheelbarrow was the biggest, and they built the Burma Road and that. And there, when they worked, the Japanese were tough. If you couldn't do the work and that shoot you ahead and roll you off the road. They wouldn't even bury you. And he went through that there. But he came out. He had met an officer, Japanese officer from Los Angeles that he went to school with. And this officer and him would get together. And when he was transferred on the Burma Road, this Japanese lieutenant was also. And he would give him a handful of rice every day and sometimes some fish and that was left over in thing. So he got to eat a little better than the other guys. When he got out, he had beautiful teeth, and a lot of them had missing teeth because they just didn't have enough vitamins and that. But he had beautiful teeth. They all wondered about that. And when the war was over and they walked out toward Shanghai, and the doctors there, the British doctors, checked them and couldn't figure out, here, all your other sailors and the army guys all have bad teeth and that, and you're the only guy who got these. And he told him he ate this rice every day. And that's what did it. Now, he died last year. He was 95, and I've been at a bunch of reunions with him for the Houston.
Well, and for folks who aren't familiar with the story, why there was a first Houston, a second Houston, and why that name has such a legacy in the Navy. This is a ship that was sunk, and for a long time, America didn't know what had happened to it. Just a portion of the crew survived, and they became prisoners of war.
They called it the Ghost That Died at Sondra Strait. Because there was nothing on that, no prisoners in that, to tell them what had happened in that. And so for 3 years, people didn't know what happened to the first Houston. And that was in 42 when they were sunk. And then the Houston was torpedoed in 44.
Yes, and for the purpose of clarification here, there have actually been four Navy ships named Houston. Well, at least three ships and one boat, as my submarine veteran friends will appreciate. There was a cargo ship named the Houston in World War I. There is a submarine today named the USS Houston. But during World War II, there were two different cruisers named Houston. We'll call them the first Houston and the second Houston. So the first Houston was sunk in the Battle of Sunda Strait, February 28, 1942. 700 men died, a little more than 350 survived, but all of them became prisoners of the Japanese. So there were no survivors to explain to the U.S. Navy what had happened. So at that point, another cruiser was named the Houston in its honor, a sort of memorial to those who had died and the ship that was lost. And this second Houston is the cruiser that you served on, Mr. Hofer.
I think it was going to be the San Jacinto. That was changed to the Houston then, our ship.
And you were part of the original crew on the Houston?
I was, yeah. I was. We did our shakedown from Hawaii to Ulithi Island somewhere, and that was the shakedown cruise and that there. And then we were in, at that time we were losing the war. Japanese were taking island after island. They had taken the Philippines, Guam, Tinian, Saipan. Ulithi had been taken. And a lot of those islands and that, they were stepping. And then all of a sudden, the Coral Sea battle was. Then I was on an aircraft carrier at that time. That was the turning point, as far as I'm concerned, of the war. Because we shot down 278 airplanes that day and lost about 25 of our own.
Well, we'll get to that, but let's talk about your time on the Houston, because it certainly ended in a very interesting manner. But first of all, why don't you tell us what were your duties on that ship?
My duties was working with the navigation department. I was a bugle master, so I had five buglers, but I didn't have to get up early in the morning to do it. The five would do that. And then I was in the navigation branch. There's 13 of us in there, and I would steer the ship 1 hour out of four when I was on duty. So I was a helmsman. Actually, I was at the helms when the first torpedo hit, and the ship just raised out of the water and dropped. And I had a helmet on, and my helmet got jammed down on my head.
Let's set the scene for this. So you're taking your turn at the helm, and you people hear torpedo, they assume that's a submarine, but these were actually planes, torpedo bomber planes that were coming. Did you have any idea they were in the area? This is off Formosa, right?
Yeah, we had 40 of them in the air that time. And in fact, after our ship was torpedoed and I was in the water and the battle was still going, oh no, I was still aboard ship, I counted 13 airplanes burning in the water at one time. And maybe 10 of them were Japanese and maybe 3 of them were in that there. So it was, if you've ever been in a battle like that, there's smoke and noise and of course your own ship get hit. It's terrible. You can't, but you do what you have to do. You know, you don't panic. You keep on working on it there, hoping it won't hit you.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it was like to be in your shoes, because here, what are you, 19, 20 years old at that point?
I was 18, yeah. I was 18 when I was a survivor. But I remember then we were going and airplanes were going over the ships and dropping torpedoes and that. And a torpedo came toward us and the captain saw it. So the captain says, right 30 degrees rudder, which is white over. So I spun the wheel over it and it was coming in like this and we were turning in at it. But we didn't get soon enough. It was too close. This airplane had come over another ship and then was between us, so they couldn't fire at him, about 20 feet off the water, and then we couldn't fire at him, and he dropped the fish, and then he went off, and we shot him down, but it was too late then.
So you turned into the path of the torpedo.
Right, yeah. There had been a typhoon through there 2 days before, so the ship was rolling quite then, so the torpedo broke the ship's keel. In the ship there is a keel that's about 10 feet high, maybe 12 inches of steel, both like an I-beam, goes the whole length of the ship. That was broken. So the ship was like that there. So the captain, we thought the ship was going to break in half. So the captain said to check with all the other officers, an hour later he says, abandon ship. Well, I was waiting and didn't get off right away. I was me and the other guy, Dwight, who had this navigator's Bible study. We were together waiting, and the guys were jumping off the side, and the boats were all going off and that. When an hour later, the captain, one of the officers told him, maybe we can save the ship. So the captain reversed his abandoned ship. But by that time, we had 1,000 guys leave already. So there was maybe 250, I have a picture of it here.
So it was a pretty skeleton crew on a wounded ship.
The ship, the bottom was, of course, there were probably 40, 50 guys in the engineering were all killed right off bat because they were underwater and that there. And the ship was down so far in the water and that there that we had no food. So the Phoenix, another cruiser came by and gave us sandwiches, and that's what this is. We're eating the first time that day.
So this is a photograph while the Houston is still afloat. It's been torpedoed once, and you're still on board, and you're saying, okay, time to eat lunch.
Yes, and what happened then, a seagoing tug came out and hooked onto us and started pulling us away from Formosa toward Ulithi. And 2 days later, a Betty, a Japanese plane, twin-engine plane, came and followed the oil slick, which is in the water, and then came out on the side and came in, dropped the torpedo. And we had no guns except 20 millimeter that was on the main deck, maybe 20 of those. And those guys opened up and they got the airplane, but here the fish was down the water, right? And the second torpedo hit under the hangar deck in back where our two airplanes were, and just broke that all up. Luckily, we had a small fire there, but it did not get into the gasoline. So we were saved that way. But we did have some fires in that aboard ship.
So at this point, you're still thinking that this ship is going to make it. But I know I'm bouncing around on you here. Before you pick it up there, I think a lot of people are saying, man, a teenager at the wheel of a ship in battle with torpedoes coming at you, getting hit by torpedoes, listening to the captain, seeing what's going on. Were you nervous? Were you scared? What in the world does that feel like?
No, you just follow orders because you've been steering the ship otherwise than that there. If he says 30 degrees right rudder, full right rudder, left to that, or come to 278, you'd say 278, you'd come to it and says, sir, we're on 278, tell him that. So you just reported the officer wasn't, he could get because you can see the torpedoes coming in. And the second one, of course, we knew when this Betty dropped that torpedo, we're going to get hit because it was so close.
Did you actually see it?
We saw the trail in the water, yeah, coming right at us. And, of course, we were dead in the water then. That was the second.
Yeah, you're being pulled along by a tug, going very slow.
And our steering aft, the steering was out, so they manually got it, the rudder straightened out, and that's where it was at. We couldn't, the engineering and that was all underwater. So there, the guys were still in there.
So when you saw that torpedo, the wake in the water coming at you.
But the officer did. Yeah. The captain saw it, yeah.
Well, maybe it's better you didn't see it.
Yeah, probably. Well, I was waiting then, and he says, somebody in there, another officer, said, we're going to catch another torpedo on that then. So we kind of braced ourselves for that one. But the first one, I didn't know. When that ship lifted up and fell like that, I didn't know what happened then.
And where were you when the second one hit?
I was on the bridge. I was on the bridge watching for other airplanes and that there, reporting them, yeah.
And how long did it take after that hit before you knew this time it was abandoned ship for good?
Oh, I'd say about a half an hour after that, the captain said abandoned ship. But to this day, I don't know when I left the ship.
Well, let's explore that in a moment because it's break time again, and I'm getting the feeling we're going to have to continue this conversation on our next episode because I know how much there is. I know there's a lot to this story, and I'm not sure that we can fit it all in today. Jonas Hofer, 89-year-old survivor of the light cruiser USS Houston, CL-81. He's our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.